Welcome to episode 329 with John Michael Montgomery. I mean, growing up, John Michael Montgomery was the man. Right now, John Michael Montgomery is the man. We learn a lot about him, but I'll just walk you through some stuff. I Swear, massive hit for him.
I swear.
Be My Baby Tonight. I Can Love You Like That.
I Can Love You Like That. I Would Make You My
Sold. The Grundy County Auction. Blah, 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 blah. This song.
Yeah.
But probably we talk about this a little bit. Life's a Dance, which
Life's a dance,
jam. So just so you can hear a little bit before you go into it, he was born 1965 in Danville, Kentucky, near Lexington. He talks about his family and how he, you know, you'll hear this and how he learned how to play music. Also pretty crazy that his brother is also a massively successful country artist. And we talk about that. His brother, by the way, is half of Montgomery Gentry. I mean, John Michael Montgomery. Last name Montgomery, the other name Montgomery.
Famous brother.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. He, and something we didn't talk about, but he has no smell at all. I forgot to ask him about this, and it's not from COVID.
Yeah, pre-existing condition.
He just has no smell. John Michael Montgomery cannot smell. So he was living COVID before it was even a thing.
Yeah.
someone once poured deer urine on his pillow to make sure he wasn't lying, and he wasn't. But, I mean, I guess you could pull that off and be like, I can't smell. But you really got to commit to
that's
it.
A
that's
a lot of commitment.
Case. Yeah. His daughter Madison just got engaged to Travis Denning. We talk about his golf career, which I did not know he was as good as he was. And then he just celebrated a 26th anniversary with his wife, Crystal. But big fan of John Michael Montgomery. Really had a great time with this interview. And I think you will like it too, especially if you love 90s country. So here you go. It is me with Mike and John Michael Montgomery. All right, we have apparently a weed eater that just went off.
Yeah.
I mean, is this the greatest timing ever that the weed eater or the whatever, the leaf blower? What would you use right now? Winter is like here and snow is melting.
I'm thinking it's probably more of a leaf blower.
Yeah, I would think so too.
Yeah, I don't think weed eaters are needed right now at this time of year, but not up here anyway.
And also, as someone who used a weed eater a lot because I had many jobs, but mostly I did golf course maintenance for a long time.
Yeah.
A weed eater is a little higher pitch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, I hate weed eating. I'll just go ahead and tell you, I got a guy that does that for me, and I'm so happy about it.
Did you have any jobs growing up? Because you grew up in Kentucky, right?
Yeah.
Like, what kind of rural jobs did you have? Because I grew up in Arkansas, and I had a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. A lot of similarities with Kentucky and Arkansas, you know. I did everything from, of course, I bagged groceries. I worked in, my mom and dad, even though they were musicians, they were butchers. They cut meat and stuff. So I would, you know, did some of that. I helped build swimming pools.
Like digging?
Yeah. You're talking about a tough job, man.
Yeah, sounds like it.
You know, you got to get down there in the bottom and you got to take a little paddle that forms the bottom, smooth it out. So, you know, when you put the vinyl on it, you know, it's nice and smooth and everything like that. And I remember we had, and it's always in the middle of the summer, you know, people want to pool.
And nobody wants one in February.
And yeah. And it's like, you know, they got these stainless steel type walls that you put up. They're in sections. And so we're down in there. And it's 100 degrees outside, and the sun's shining and reflecting all that heat down on us while we're down in there. Now, you know, I was like, I don't know, I was probably 17, 18 years
still
old.
Still hot. Okay, how old are you?
And let me tell you something. I mean, we all pretty much stripped down to our underwear almost to do this job, you know, and a lot of times we did it in the middle of the night when it was cooler, of course.
Really?
Yeah, because, I mean, it was just so hot. And your knuckles would get all wore out, you know, from the paddles trying to. And then I remember one time we didn't do a good enough job for the guy that owned the company. He pulled in there and shined his. It was almost midnight. He comes in there, shines his light down in there, walks down in there, starts taking his foot and just tearing the crap out of everything. He's like, this is not good enough. We ended up staying until about 4 a.m. in the morning. You know, I was getting paid $3.35 an hour or something like that, seems like, you know. I mean, yeah, but I wasn't afraid to, if somebody wanted to pay me to, you know, give me a job, I never did a job like I waited tables at Chi Chi's, which I enjoyed, but I sucked at it. I mean, I was, you know, I wasn't afraid to tackle anything. And I put in 110%. I knew I was like, I'm not going to do this for the rest of my life, but I, you know, I'm going to put it, give the best I got. But I remember turning 20 in a day, and in Kentucky, you can serve alcohol and be a server in restaurants at 20 in a day. And I love their chips. They had great chips at Chi Chi's. You know, a lot of people don't know what Chi Chi's is.
I don't know what Chi Chi's is.
So Chi Chi's is
chili is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it was a big, huge Mexican chain restaurant. I mean, they were everywhere. And the rumor is the guy that started Chi Chi's, he named it after his wife's big boobs. I think that's what
Chi Chi's. Yeah, her Chi Chi's. Is this a rumor? You couldn't ask the guy?
I just know that that's what they said. Okay. Unfortunately, you know, a few years back, the last Chi Chi's, I think they had a lettuce issue with, you know, a bunch of people getting sick, and it put them out of business. But I loved the place because they had great chips, and of course, the bartender I knew pretty well, he'd sneak me a jumbo margarita.
I feel like it'd be hard to sneak a jumbo.
Yeah.
Like sneaking a small margarita, but sneaking a jumbo doesn't feel very sneaky.
Yeah, well, you know, it's you got to know sometimes, you know, when it was slow. I was a terrible server. My shift was from 11 a.m. until like 2 or 3, and in the middle of the week, there wasn't a whole lot of people coming. On the weekends.
They don't put the A-plus servers at 11 to 2 or 3 on a Wednesday.
The evenings, obviously, the servers were, they would make $500, $600 in tips, you know, and I was like, wow, you know, I'd make maybe $30. But I was singing, making music, playing music at night, so it worked perfectly for me, you know, because I went on stage at 9 o'clock, I finished up about 1 a.m., and gave me just a little extra money to put a little gas in my car and buy some, you know. I didn't have to buy any food because we got food for 50% off there. So, but I ended up, I had to end up quitting because, like I said, I was not very good at this job. So I had this couple and their 7-year-old daughter came in. They sat down, and they all ordered daiquiris. And of course, the little girl, they ordered not a daiquiri for her,
like a virgin daiquiri.
Yeah, it's call them not a.
Oh, they do call it that. Yeah, yeah, got it.
And I forgot to write nada down on.
You got
to
be kidding me! You got to be kidding me!
And so I go to the bartender who sneaks me margaritas, you know, and I told him, I said, "Hey, see that mom and dad and the little girl over there at that table there?" I said, "I ordered 3 daiquiris. One of them's supposed to be a nada. Did I write nada on that ticket?" He looks at it and goes, "Nope, that's a real daiquiri." I went, "Oh, this is not good." I said, "That little girl's drinking a real daiquiri." So here comes, we called him Taco. He was the floor manager. Comes out there and we tell him the situation, you know, and he goes over there and talks to him. He comes back and he's like, "They're all cool. It's like we, you know," they were wondering why she was drinking it so fast.
That stinks. That's funny.
So I was like, I probably need to find another gig, you know, another job. This one right here, probably. I don't need to be serving 7-year-olds. Yeah, I got a one-track mind, basically. I mean, I can't shuffle other jobs. I'm terrible at, what do they call it?
Like multitasking?
Multitasking, so awful at it.
What would you be thinking? Would you be thinking about your music career all day? Is that what was really happening in your mind at the time when you're waiting tables? Or were you just like, I don't like doing this?
No, I mean, I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed meeting the people. I just, the way my brain operates, it wasn't, you got to be able to multitask to be a good server.
I was the best.
Yeah.
I was the best server in the land.
So you got 3 or 4 tables going on and you got a, you know, I just wasn't able to do it. I couldn't, it was like, I can sit down with a guitar or I can sit down with a video game and I will master the guitar or the video game because I can spend hours at that one thing and never leave, you know. Or I can sit and watch a bobber fishing for hours on a day and wait for that thing to go under and, you know, and I'm, you know. I got the patience of Job with that, but I can't do multitasking.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, it's easy to distract me for one thing, you know.
Well, to be fair, I couldn't remember orders without writing them down. I was a write-down server. Other than that, that's pretty A+. I do want to get to the video game thing. You play video games?
I used to dominate them. I could.
What was your system?
I just spent a lot of time on them.
Like Nintendo, Sega.
Oh.
N64.
Yeah. Well, I started off with the Atari. Mm-hmm. You know,
mm-hmm. Like Pong, Pac-Man. Yeah, I remember the Atari. Mm-hmm.
And then all that, and then a lot of guys, when I was in high school, and we'd go to the bowling alley in Danville or someplace like that. There was always a lot of guys were hanging out, you know, out there checking out the girls. I was going into the video game place and putting quarters
in. Did they have arcade? Was it an arcade?
It was an arcade. Arcades were huge back then, you know, and then you went in and I would literally just take my quarters in there and just play all these different video games a lot of times. And, while my brother Eddie was out chasing the girls, you know, but I loved video, still love them today. I mean, I think it was one of that trait, probably, like when it came to playing music. I mean, I was steadfast. I mean, when I got a full-time gig playing guitar, singing at a club, I mean, it was like I was on it, you know. I'd be there when the doors opened up. I'd go up there and I'd practice a new song and this and that. It kept me focused. It was easy to focus on stuff like that, you know, but if I liked, just like golf, I mean, once I started playing golf, I thought it was the silliest game in the world. And when I played basketball and baseball back in high school, I had some buddies that played golf and I'd just laugh at them. And then I had a bass player who I couldn't get to come to practice because he was all the time golfing. And I was like, what do you like about that? What is it? You know, he said, come with me one day. So I go out with him and I start slicing the ball, you know, like everybody does. And I play 9 holes with him on his little course. And after that, I was absolutely absorbed. I went to the practice range every day after that because I was like, I know I can hit this ball straight, you know. And, I mean, it was literally, it was on. I mean, I was just absolutely ate up with it. And I started playing 100, 150 rounds a year.
Wow. You still play?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been able to play much lately because of back spasms, but
you still like to play.
Love it. I mean, I wish I would play every day. I literally got down to about a 3 handicap.
Wow.
I was taking lessons from, I got a lesson from one of the Harmon brothers. Everywhere I went, I got lessons. When I was 35 years old, I loved the game so much. I was playing on the Celebrity Pro Tournament.
You were like legitimately good, and that happened because your bass player was like, hey, come play.
You got
so absorbed.
It was like there's just certain things that gets me addicted to it, and once I'm addicted to it, my personality just takes over, and it's just like I've got to master this.
Were you a natural athlete in high school?
Well, I mean, I was pretty good, but I mean, I played basketball. I played okay. I mean, I played a little baseball. Baseball bored me, so I quit playing that. And I just love action. I like things that keep me, you know, give me action. You know, I mean, I loved football more than anything. I loved high school football, college football. Mom would never let me play. And, you know, I remember when I turned 18 years old, I was a senior in high school. And I said, Mom, I'm going out for the football team this year, and you can't stop me because I'm 18 years old now. And she was like, well, that's fine. She says, I don't want to hear you complaining when you break your fingers and you can't play guitar anymore. And I went, okay, I didn't think about that. So I went to school, worked out with the guys, and started saying, can I look at your fingers? They went, yeah, I was like, did you break any? Have you ever? Oh, yeah, man, I had this one. All these gross stories about fingers. And, I mean, and some of them still were crooked and everything. And I was like, I guess I'm going to be playing football. I'm just going to have to, you know. It was bad enough to jam my finger when I was playing basketball. music, obviously, being from a musical family. I remember coming home, had to wash the dishes, clean the house, make the beds, do my homework, and then I'd pick up my guitar, and I would sit and listen to whatever song I loved or wanted to sing or play, and I would just sit there for hours and hours and hours.
Focused. Like the thing that happened later but happened early with you with the guitar.
Yeah. And
so wait, your parents were musicians, you say, your mother and your father. Did they both play? Did one sing?
They were mostly weekends. My mom played drums for my dad. He had a hard time keeping drummers. And, of course, my mom's, you know, side of the family was, you know, they were a little musical, too, could sing and stuff. But dad couldn't keep a drummer in the band, you know. And so she said, well, maybe I'll learn to play drums. And dad went, he called her Snooky. That was her nickname. He went, Snooky, women don't play drums. Well, that was it. I mean, the next day there was a set of drums sitting in the living room when I came home from school, and I went, it's on. Yeah, and she ended up being my dad's drummer and did a great job for, you know, family band, and she was a good singer too, of course, you know, sang. And then me and Eddie, of course, when we got a little older, got to become teenagers, we started joining the band, playing with them on the weekends. And
what roles did you and Eddie do? Like, did you guys sing at all? Were you just the background players?
We sang, yeah. I mean, Eddie and I would, when we were kids, dad would get me and Eddie up on stage, and we'd sing a little Elvis or something, or, you know, and it was kind of more of just for part of the show, you know, but they got us singing at an early age, and we both could, you know, hold a pitch pretty good at that age, and, you know, the crowd loved it and everything, so we were just kind of part of the entertainment, you know. And dad would do his Opry stage. He'd dress up like Dolly Parton and Loretta Lynn. He'd stuff, you know.
Chi-Chi's.
Oh, yeah. Chi-Chi's in there, and come out, and he'd put a blonde wig on and do a Dolly Parton song, and then he'd do Loretta Lynn. And then he had a Grand Ole Opry. That's how he learned to play. He didn't have a TV growing up, so they listened to the Grand Ole Opry on the radio. And he learned to play guitar and all that stuff by doing that, so he loved that. But, they just played, everything from VFWs to skating rinks to, you know, private parties on the weekends, and they dragged the kids along with them, obviously, you know. Couldn't really afford to pay for a babysitter. We had one from time to time, but, you know, we just grew up with it, and we had musicians coming over all the time, you know, and they'd leave at 1 a.m. in the morning, so we'd get up. A lot of times we'd stay awake till 1 a.m., get up, go to school the next day, and sleepy-eyed and all that kind of stuff, but it was fun. We moved around a lot.
Around the country, around Kentucky?
Oh, just central Kentucky.
Yeah.
I mean, Dad had several different jobs. I mean, he worked on televisions. He had TV shops. He did butchers. He drove a bulldozer. He the only thing he really stayed consistent at was playing and picking music. He loved it, you know, but the other jobs, a lot of times, they didn't pay as much, and we rented a lot, so when the rent went up or he didn't make enough money, we moved to a different place, so we moved around a lot, you know.
Did he want to be a professional musician?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he even put out, little 45 back in his day and everything like that, and his dream was to play on the Opry, and his dream, obviously, was to make it in Nashville. But him and mom had kids really early. I mean, he was like 20, and she was, you know, 18 or 17, you know, whatever. I mean, it was – so when you have two kids and then a third one came along later, I mean, you just can't drop everything you're doing and go, well, you know, I want to try to be a star. See y'all later. Good luck, you know. So, I mean, he stuck around him and mom just – you know, they stuck around and, you know, made their music around locally. And so they keep a roof over me and Eddie's head. And when we were young, and our sister Becky came along later, and that's what they did. I mean, so one of the reasons that I, you know, did not get married till I was 30 was I had the dream, obviously, like he did. And I just knew that if I got married at a young age, had kids, it was really going to make it hard for me to make that happen, you know, harder to make it happen.
Do you think you had the dream because it was your dad's dream? Or do you think you had the dream because you kind of got a taste of it playing with your dad?
No, it was definitely getting on stage. I didn't understand it, and, you know, when I was a kid getting on stage, it was just for fun. But then when I started playing guitar and I got on stage for the first time with Dad and Mom as a rhythm guitar player, and I was a good background vocalist, and he let me sing a couple of songs, and I had these girls screaming at me. You know, I was like 14 years old at the time, 15 years old, and I was like, okay. So me singing and holding a guitar, the girls pay attention to me. Yeah. I couldn't get them to pay attention to me before. So I remember going back to, I went and did this high school variety thing, and I sang a Willie Nelson song, Angels Flying Too Close to the Ground. And I was trying to sound like him, Angels Flying Too Close, you know, playing a little old Mossberg or Moss Wright guitar that a guy gave me. I got finished singing in the gymnasium. All the girls were screaming at me, and I was like, this is what I want to do. I went and told my coach Hollebeck. I was playing basketball, and I wasn't starting anyway, but I told him, I said, Coach, I just saw him the other day. As a matter of fact, we laughed about this. I said, I'm going to have to quit the basketball team. He said, why? I said, playing in my mom and dad's band, you know, and they play on Friday sometimes, and I really love that, and that's what I want to do, and I have to make a choice. And he said, well, that's just a silly dream. You just, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then I seen him a few years later when he retired at the, he's doing security at the airport in Lexington, and I think I might have been my second year out after Life's a Dance and all that. And he said, come up to me. He's like, I just want to tell you. I tell all my kids when, after you made it, like, if anybody ever comes up to you and says, you know, don't ever think, if you got dreams, don't let anybody ever tell you that it can't happen for you. And then he would tell them the story about that, you know. And he says, because I told this young man one time, it was a serious dream. He didn't need to quit the basketball team. And, you know, and then he said, it's John Michael Montgomery and all that stuff. So it was a fun story. He's a great guy. But it really was hard for me. I really liked playing basketball for him. But, you know, it just, once I get,
yeah.
It just takes that magical moment for me, just like when I hit that first golf ball, and I was like, I get it now.
I'm so blown away that you got that good at golf. My mind is blown that you were that competitive. But it does seem like, just as you're talking about things, that your personality is to find and focus and then master. And it's pretty cool. Like, I can respect that. You know, when you talk about how you play guitar when you were younger, what's the age difference between you and your brother?
Year and a half.
Wow, that's so close.
Yeah.
Now, did he have the same dreams to be a country star?
I think we both actually, you know, wasn't like we wanted to be famous right off the bat. We just loved to get on stage and perform. And then we got better at it. And then we started our own band, a little three-piece band with a bass player guy, a good friend of ours, Tim Williams. And we did that around Frankfurt and different places on the weekends. And then a job, a full-time five-night-a-week gig opened up in Lexington. And that was our dream, was sort of like, are we good enough to do that?
But what was it 5 nights a week? Was it a restaurant? Was it
no,
a club?
No, it was a club. Yeah, a club called Austin City Saloon.
And you were like the house band?
Yeah. And a guy named Greg Austin played there. No relation. I mean, the Austin City Saloon and Greg Austin, I don't think they named it after him, but we used to go in there and watch him play. And that's where I met Troy Gentry at, believe it or not. Me and him first met there.
So you met Troy before your brother did.
Mm-hmm.
And what was Troy, did he live up there?
Yeah, he was from Lexington. Yeah, and he was doing like I was. He was just going around to different places, getting up on stage, trying to make a name for himself. And we kind of got to be pretty good buddies, actually. And then when Greg left Austin City, it got sold, and another guy bought it out. He was having a hard time drawing a crowd in there. And my brother Eddie told him, said, we can draw a crowd in there. So
could you? Or was he just saying that to get the gig?
Well, I think Eddie was just saying that to get the gig, but he was, he's the best. Let me tell you something. Eddie is, he can BS. He's just full of it. I mean, I love it because he can literally talk I mean, he'll talk a, you know, fish out of water. I mean, fishing or whatever, whatever the saying is. I mean, Eddie always had really cool cars because he just had that knack. I had pieces of junk that I had constantly work on all the time. And I was like, man, he got a good cool car. And then he'd trade it off for another cool car. But Eddie was really good with that salesman. He could call people up and talk to them and talk them into stuff. And so the guy gave us an opportunity. Eddie says, hey, this guy's, we got to put a band together because at the time we were disbanded. And I was like, okay. I said, we'll get Tim Williams. Eddie's going to play drums for me. That's what Eddie did for me, played drums. And Troy, I asked Troy if he'd be part of the band. And he said, yeah. So it was me, Eddie, Tim Williams, and Troy Gentry, and we called it John Michael Montgomery and Young Country. And then we added a keyboard player.
It's John Michael Montgomery and Montgomery Gentry, basically. And
yeah,
Tim.
Exactly. So, I mean, the guy gave us, he said, I'll give you guys 2 weeks. If you show, you start bringing a crowd in here. We started packing the place. I mean.
Why do you think that is?
Because I knew what kind of music that place, Texas Two-Stepping, was getting really popular at the time. Greg Austin played a lot of songs, and I would watch these people do these two-step, Texas Two-Step and line dancing. This is, you know, 1986, 87. And I was like, what kind of dance is that? You know, and they was like, Texas Two-Step. And it was beginning to sweep the country. And so I went in there, and of course I played a lot of George Strait stuff. And I mean, we all sang everything from Bob Seger to George Strait. We covered it all. And I mean, and plus we were a bunch of young, single guys that liked to have a lot of fun. So it was UK, you know, college town. I mean, we packed the place. I mean, we started packing the place. And then, you know, so it became a good gig for us for a while. And then on Sundays, me and Troy was trying to make a little extra money. So we would actually get together, and his dad owned a little restaurant. We talked his dad into letting me and Troy go in there on a Sunday because they weren't doing any business. He was thinking about closing it up. It's called The Grapevine. And we asked him if he'd let us come in there on Sunday, and me and Troy would just do a little duo.
And you were the original Montgomery Gentry.
Absolutely. And every time I'd see Troy, I'd go, you know that me and you were the first Montgomery Gentry, don't you? And he'd just smile real big.
So what's that dynamic? Yeah. Because did you move to Nashville first? And if you and your brother were already playing together, why did you not duo up? Like,
well, I mean, here's where my head was when I was about 24 years old, playing five nights a week. I was like, I saw a lot of the musicians around town. They're 35, 40 years old, still, you know, and playing four and five nights a week. And I just didn't want to be that. I was like, by the time I'm 30, I want to know what I'm going to choose. Am I going to continue I don't want to continue playing clubs. I either need to go to Nashville and try to make a living singing demos, writing songs, doing something, but I don't want to be a nightclubber the rest of my life. And either that or I just need to go get a real job, you know, and have some kids and family and just enjoy music on the weekends.
Like build a swimming pools down 100 degrees underneath the ground with the paddles, swimming pulling it up. You're already good at it.
Yeah, and so literally I had made up my mind once I turned 25 I was going to make a decision to move down here. Well, just so happened Nashville started looking for talent outside of Nashville. And there was a guy up in Lexington that was doing a showcase for Atlantic Records. And the manager of that guy stopped by the bar to listen to this song that his artist that he got on Atlantic loved. So I sang it for him. It's called A Few Cent Short. I wrote it. And I got done, and I said, well, how you like it? He went, I like you. He's like, if you'll let me manage you, I'll get you on Lamp Records. I was like, nah.
Wow, he said that?
Yeah.
Did you believe him?
No. I mean, I was like, this guy's just telling me what I want to hear. And I said, it's a deal. If you get me on Atlantic Records, yeah, sure, I'll let you manage me, you know. Estill Sowards was his name. He's an old coal miner, Eastern Kentucky guy, silk shirt and a gold nugget, you know. And I was like, there's no way this guy's even going to come through for me. Dang if he didn't, you know. And I remember riding down in his Cadillac for the first time. We run out of fuel because he bleeped. It had that little extra fuel thing on it.
Yeah.
He bleeped that. And right before we ran out of fuel, he looked at me, he said, those dimples are going to be worth $1 million each. And I was like, I said, Estill, come on. I said, that's just silly, you know. The guy dreamed big. I loved it about him, you know. He had a little stutter and stuff, had real deep voice and everything. It was, I said, you can't ever trust that extra fuel thing on there, Estill. I had to walk half a mile up a hill to a little white home, knock on the door. Didn't have no cell phones back then. This was 1991. And, you know, a little old lady is like, we run out of fuel. We're on 65, you know.
Did she have fuel?
She called the fuel station that had whatever they call it, the AAA. Or whatever,
yeah.
You know, and they came down, brought some fuel and everything like that. But
was that your first time going to Nashville?
No, I went to Nashville a long time ago, back in around 80. I'm thinking it was 84, 85. I remember coming into town. I had this guitar player. It was me and Eddie and Tim, and he was a long-haired rock and roller guitar player, you know. And we come rolling into Nashville, and that's when Alabama had that huge Alabama sign there on Division Street or Music Row, whatever it was. They had a huge store there. And their name, Alabama, was on top of it, and it was just flickering. And I was like, wow, that is so cool. I've got to go into there. Of course, you know, George Strait, Lionel Richie, Alabama, that's where I got all my chops from. I mean, you know, it was just like love songs and stuff like that. I mean, I was fortunate enough. So getting back to the story, that guy, they came up to see that guy sing and showcase, and it was right down the road from me. And they weren't impressed, I guess. By him. And so this guy comes into the bar, and it's on a weeknight, so it's like we could tell this guy's from out of town. There ain't nobody in the bar.
Right.
He didn't look like he'd ever been there, hadn't seen him before. So I get done with the set, and I walk over to him, and he's like, yeah. He said, I'm from Atlantic Records. He's like, I was over there listening to this guy, and he didn't impress me. So I asked the waitress, I said, is there any other place anybody singing around here? And she said, well, the best singer in town is right down the road here, John Michael Montgomery.
Wow.
And he went, really? And I said, so whoever that waitress is,
you still don't know.
I don't know who it is. Thank you very much.
We have her on the phone right now.
Yeah.
Betsy, you there?
But I was like, well, I appreciate it. And he said, you know what? I just, after that said, she's right. She says, I got the rest of them coming over.
Oh, that's
to
so
visit.
Cool.
And, you know, and that's.
What does your brother think about that? That, okay, you're going to go sign to Atlantic. Does he follow you down?
Yeah. I mean, he's been my.
Or did he come with you?
Yeah, he come with me. I mean, we went to Nashville together. We did everything together. He had a life. I mean, he had kids and married and all that stuff. But anytime we did music, anything like that, I mean, we did it together. I mean, he played drums for me. But once I started coming to Nashville, I was playing at Austin City 5 nights a week. He had to kind of hold the roost down there because I now was recording Life's a Dance. From Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then I would drive back and Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, I would sing at Austin City. And so, you know, he was him and Tim and Troy and all of them. Well, I think Troy might actually did his own gig at that point. But, you know, then I would come in and, you know, because I still had to make a living. I mean, you know, I was making $150 a week,
yeah.
You know, and I wasn't getting paid anything to record at that point.
Right, recording didn't pay the bills.
Yeah, and so anyway, I did that for a year because they had a big changeover at Atlantic Records, and Rick Blackburn ended up taking over the whole thing, and other guy left, and this and that, and we changed producers. You know, Doug Johnson came into the picture, and I think basically was the reason that I have a career today. I mean, he brought Life's a Dance, I Love the Way You Love Me, Beer and Bones. I mean, he was very instrumental. I mean, he looked around because the guy that left Atlantic was the guy that was supposed to produce me. And once he left, I had to find a new producer.
Right. Well, you talk about Life's a Dance, which was your first single. Yeah. But I was looking it up, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. And again, there are a few songs. You have a bunch. You have, according to, depending on which chart you look at, you have 7 number ones. How many do you think you have? How many do you claim? Because it gets different wherever you look.
Yeah, well, on Billboard, I think it was 14. Or no, Billboard, it was like 7. And then we had the other one that everybody, all the, heck, what was it called?
Well, let's just say 8, just for our sake.
So I had 14 number ones on the other one, which is the one that.
What's the other one? All Montgomery All the Time, that chart?
No, there was Billboard, and then there was Billboard only went by what they, you know, you couldn't call Billboard up in, or the stations up and say, add my
like song. A media base type chart?
It was basically the chart that Nashville used when all these states, they would call in, and then they would add, that's where they could call in and get ads for, I can't think of that name. It was huge. It was big as Billboard, but it was basically what Nashville went by as a number one, not the public.
Well, let's go with 14 number ones because it's all the same to me.
Yeah.
So your first song, Life's a Dance, 1992, all I did was look at the Billboard chart, and I think that's the song that I associate with you the most. That and probably Grundy County Auction. But Life's a Dance. And Billboard, it did not go number one, which was wild to think that song, which is the song that I associate you and my childhood with. But when that song hit, is that a song that got bigger as time went on?
Well, I just think it's like, first of all, I didn't want that song to come out first. I wanted I Love the Way You Love Me to come out first because I was like, that's a love song.
Did they say no ballad, no love song? Is that why?
Well, they explained it to me. It's like, look, and I was used to singing George Strait, Keith Whitley. Life's a Dance is a philosophical kind of song about, I just never had really sang a song. It's like, I didn't even know if I was good at singing a song like that. But Doug Johnson said, hey, this song's perfect for you, and it's a perfect one to come out with. And I just was like, well, we'll probably be lucky to break top 40 with it, you know. But, hey, I mean, what do I know? I'm new. These guys know what they're doing, so let's do it, you know. I like this song. I just, you know, I've gravitated towards the love song or the good old hardcore country, you know, heartbreaking song. And so, sure enough, broke top 40, top 30. Took forever to get up there, and it finally broke top 5, went to number 4. And, I mean, of course, I was thinking, wow, I got a top 5 out of this, you know. And but most people, just like with me and Bob Seger and some old people can't believe how many of those big rock bands had big hits, but they didn't go
but
number
no
one.
Number ones. Yeah, Aerosmith didn't have a number one until Armageddon, the movie. Yeah. Like a love song way later, and they had so many massive songs.
Massive hits that never went to number one. And you would think every one of those were number ones. And I think Bob Seger was kind of the same way. I mean, I couldn't believe that all those big hits he had wasn't number one hits, but they weren't. Well, it's kind of the same way with Life's a Dance and Beer and Bones and a few others. Some of them, you know, get obviously better as time goes on, and they get bigger as time goes on. And like, for instance, right now, when I go and do a show, in the 90s, everybody wanted to come and hear me sing Life's a Dance and I Swear and I Love the Way You Love Me but now everybody wants to come hear me sing Sold to Grundy County Auction, because that next generation that were little bitty kids when those songs were out are now going to the bars and places and going out, and they want to come hear me sing that song, you know. And I mean, it's actually bigger than I Swear. It's probably out. All the numbers, it probably outperforms in every way, too. I remember when I did Be My Baby Tonight, Atlantic Records, especially Rick, they went, that's a stupid song. I grew up listening to Buck Owens and people like that. I was like, people love those kind of songs. And when Be My Baby Tonight went number one, I think it went number one.
Yeah, it did. 1994.
When I came out with the next album, and I had sold to Grundy County Auction there. Rick was like, you ain't gonna hear nothing from me.
You know? I would think that if you're playing a show,
yeah,
and you know, we talk about the difference in number ones, but also like career-defining songs, yeah, that you could just get up and go, when I was, and the crowd just sings, yeah, the rest of the whole, they can sing the rest of the song.
I'm surprised at how popular that song became. It still surprises me today. I didn't realize how much it meant to a lot of people out there that struggled in their life, had struggles in their life. And, you know, and I would, I still do meet and greets, but I did a lot of meet and greets back in the 90s. And the people that would come up and tell me their personal stories, I mean, I was just like, oh, wow. Well, you know, I mean, you don't realize how much, when you grow up singing other people's songs in a bar, and then all of a sudden you create your own, you don't realize how much they can mean in people's right. lives until you start getting the personal stories. And then at that point, I was like, wow, okay, I get that song a lot more now than I did back then.
I Love the Way You Love Me. It's a 3-week number one. This is your second single, right? So if I'm right, you can correct me. Life's a Dance comes out first. Mm-hmm. And then I Love the Way comes out second. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, let me play a clip here for everybody. Everybody knows it, but just for my sake.
But I love the way you love me.
You kind of got your way there. You had to put out your love song that you're waiting on. Did you feel that after the success of Life's a Dance, that song, like you had a great feeling about that?
I was, when that song came out after the success of Life's a Dance. And, of course, hearing Bob Kingsley say my name on the Top 40 Countdown was probably the highlight of my life back then. That was, you know, loved that man. And listening to that every weekend at Top 40 Countdown. And then when I Love the Way You Love Me went number one, I was actually writing back. I was back home on the Lake Harrington back there with some buddies, and Frank Myers, who wrote, co-wrote, I Swear, was right. He came up to write with me. And I finally told Frank, I said, you know, we had a little cassette player, you know, we'd put stuff down. I said, Frank, Bob Kingsley's about to mention that I've got the number one record on American Country Countdown. He's like, I'm just going to have to take a break. I ain't worth the crap of being right, and I'll just be honest with you. He said, that's fine. He said, could you listen to this song real quick? I think it's perfect for you. He said, I co-wrote this a few years ago, and I can't get to get it pitched anymore, so I carried it around with me, and it was I Swear. Mm. And he'd pitched it to Scott Hendricks, who, you know, produced that album with I Swear on it, and I was like, I love it. And but when it went number one, hearing Bob Kingsley say my name, and I had a number one record, I mean, it was an incredible moment. I mean, that was probably as big as when I heard Life's a Dance on a radio station that would, you know, out on a...
You randomly heard it somewhere that wasn't home.
Yeah, but I cheated on it because I was playing golf with one of the radio guys here in Nashville. And we got done playing golf. And,
that's funny.
And he was like, he said, so what did it feel like to hear your song on the radio? I said, I haven't heard it yet. He went, you ain't. It's like, we play it all the time. I said, I don't live down here. I live in Kentucky. And I said, I haven't been able to catch it up there either. And he goes, so he makes a phone call to his guy and says, I got John Michael in the car. Play Life's a Dance next. We're getting ready to stop and have some wings and stuff and everything. So, I mean, it was a cool feeling. And then after that, it's like, you know, when you buy a new car, you see the same car. Everybody's got one after that. I started hearing it everywhere. And,
that's got to be cool, though.
It's
everywhere. You probably hear it at the grocery store. You probably hear it in the car.
The craziest thing, even today, it's and I guarantee you other artists will tell you this. I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a truck stop or I've walked into any of these other places and they're playing the music on the speakers that one of my songs are playing. I mean, and I know they're not playing me 24/7. It's just it's just kind of like, wow. I've walked into places, I can't tell you how many times that happens, and it's just the coincidence is almost...
when you have so many number one songs that were songs of a generation, I mean, there's only so many songs that I can hear it assigns me back to where I was at that time. And a lot of your music does that. I mean, you mentioned I Swear, and it started with you, but then I remember All for One also singing it, you know? But it started with you, right? Like, you had the song, you sang the song. Did they approach you, or did they approach your label or the writer?
So this is what happened with that song. And, you know, I had Rick Blackburn. He, you know, he wanted to meet with me one day, so I met with him, and he was like, look, he said, what do you think about going pop with the song?
You going pop.
Me going pop with it.
Interesting.
And I just told him, I said, Rick, I don't care anything about it. I was like, I don't want to be a pop singer. I'm like, I think the song is definitely good enough to go pop. But I said, just to be honest with you, I'm happy with where I'm at. I want to be considered a country music singer and not a crossover or any of that kind of stuff. And he said, well, he said, I have to tell you, there's another group up in Atlantic, New York is going to put out on the R&B section they want to put it out. And I was like, let them do it, you know? And he said, well, I just wanted to talk to you about it first. And obviously he just didn't want me to be surprised, you know.
Did you like it? Were you happy? Were you unhappy that they were doing it? Or was it so out of your control that you were just like, it is what it is?
You know, I really felt like the song was bigger than me anyway. I thought it was just the song exploded. I was like, wow, this thing is huge. But I kind of felt like, you know, the song deserves to be heard by another genre, it's just that good. And I just wasn't interested in being that person to go over and cross over into the pop world with it and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I just never did have any desires for that. And so when it came out, I was like, I was actually kind of wanting to see how they did it. You know, it's like, how are they going to do this differently, you know, than I did, you know, and it not be a copycat or whatever, but they pulled it off nicely. Yeah. You know,
I'm going to play a couple clips. This is your version. 4 weeks at number one on the country chart. This thing sat at number one for a month, which is wild to think about. Here is I Swear. By the moon and the stars, which this song, again, reminds me of being a young teenager and having nobody want to slow dance with me. That's what the song reminds me of.
Yeah.
Like, all right, slow dance time. Not a single girl. Not a one.
Hey, I know exactly where you're coming from. I mean,
and here is All for One's version, I Swear. I swear by the moon and the stars. But the crazy thing is it happened again. Yeah. Because you put out I Can Love You Like That.
Yeah.
And here's a clip of that. Love you like that, I would make you my A year world. Later. This is only a year later. Yeah. So was it the similar circumstance?
No, completely different. And it's funny because we were having a get-together at Rick Blackburn's home in the backyard, and I ran into one of the All for One guys.
In Nashville?
A couple of them. Yeah, they had came to Rick's place, too. And they were, I forgot what the celebration was for. It was for us artists, but all the big New York guys were in town, LA guys were in town, everything. And I remember talking to the lead singer, you know, he was like, we were talking about being a studio, and I cut another big old ballad. I said, you guys are here. I said, he said, really? I said, yeah. I said, yeah, it's called I Can Love You Like That. He went, well, we just finished that song. I went, what? they went, yeah, we just finished that song too. So what we figured out, the publishing company, and I think the co-writer was Steve Diamond on that song, I believe, if I remember right. But anyway, they were like, hey, let's pitch this song to both of these guys at the same time. And there was really no competition. I mean, they had their side, I had my side. And so we put it out at the same time, and both covers were huge, you know.
Did you guys ever perform together?
We did. We performed once on the Grammy back in
probably 95, 96, somewhere around in there.
I remember I had a cold, and I shouldn't even been there, but I I had to go. It was my first time. So I didn't sound that good when I did my part. But
well, you have 14 yeah. number ones. Yeah. I mean, you have an entire set list of, and I'm going to roll through some of these just for the sake. I'm jealous you have a sweet tea, by the way. I saw you drinking it, and I was like, dang, I wish I had a sweet tea right now. I love The Way You Love Me, 1993. We touched on this one. I Swear, 1994, as we mentioned, a four-week number one. Another multi-week number one, Be My Baby Tonight. Which between this and Sold, the Grundy County Auction, that's a lot of words. I mean,
yeah,
you're constant with the words.
It's an easier song to sing than I Love the Way You Love Me because you don't think about it. You're just rambling right through them and boom, 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 where when you're singing a love song, it's a process. If you're singing,
if you say so, it sounds like a lot of words. Yeah. You know, it just sounds like a lot of words.
You're trying, yeah. But the thing about I Swear, which it actually could have been number one longer. At that time period, all the radio stations, the big P1s as we called them, had put a 12-week limit on songs.
Period. Not just at number one, but period.
Yeah.
Wow, just period. Existing on the
so
chart.
So you 12 weeks on the charts, and you were it's going bye-bye. That's how much, that's how popular the country music industry
I mean, it's
were.
40 weeks now. It's 40, you know? 50 weeks nowadays.
Yeah, and it's like, I was thinking this thing could, you know, I mean, because back in the day in the 50s and 60s, and you had those guys, I mean, they'd have a number one that lasted for 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them old guys, and I was thinking, man, this song could pull that off. And then all of a sudden, the new rule was on a lot of these P1 stations, 12 weeks, and we pull it. We don't care how popular it is. And so they pulled, I Swear, after the fourth week of being number one. After the 4 weeks of number one, they pulled it, not because it couldn't have still been number one. I was like, man.
I say justice for John. That's what
I
say.
Yeah, I was
get
like.
Get back on there.
Dang, man. Here I was going to hope maybe Eddie Arnold's record or something, you know.
If You've Got Love from 1994. You've got love, you can move a mountain. I Can Love You Like That, 1995. I Can Love You Like That. Sold, the Grundy County Auction Incident. And I said, hey, pretty lady, won't you give me a sign? I'd give anything to make you mine on mine. I never say incident. I'll be honest with you. Mostly it's always Grundy County.
Yeah.
Sometimes if I'm really feeling it, I'll say sold, the Grundy County Auction. I never say incident.
To be honest with you, I forget that incident's part of the name.
So do I. I mean, I'm reading it because I wrote it down, but I'll be honest.
I just call it sold, and yeah. You know, and then I remember when I put that song out and I did the video up there. The director of the video, producer, whatever you would call him, he called me up. He was trying to find stockyards, you know, and he was like, John, I cannot find a good stockyards. They're all made out of blocks and this and that. And he's like, I want to. Old-fashioned wooden style. You know where it went at? I said, oh, yeah. I said, Lancaster, Kentucky, just right up the road from me. I was like, I went to school there and everything. I used to walk by that place every day. I said, it's a cool little stockyards. He goes in, checks it out, falls in love with it, and we do the video right there. And I had all these, of course, it's in Garrett County, Lancaster is. So I had all these people at the video going, I can't believe you wrote that song and you didn't call it Garrett County instead of Grundy County. Where's Grundy County? I said, I didn't write the song. I just sang this song. I said, if I would have wrote the song, I would have figured out a way to make it Garrett County. But I said, it's Grundy County, Tennessee, I think, but I'm not sure. There's a lot of Grundy counties out there. But and I said, you know, they got after me. They thought, well, I can't believe you're doing a song here in Garrett County and you didn't even mention it in your song. Yeah.
2000, The Little Girl, number one, 3 weeks. And the drinking and the fighting just got worse every night behind their couch. You know, I'm looking at you here. Is your Kentucky blue, is that what the vest is? Is it purposefully Kentucky blue? Or is it just you just got a lot of blue?
Well, I do have a lot of blue, but the wife picked this out for me this morning.
So, nice. Did a good job. Wait, is she in town?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So one of my friends is Travis, who is marrying your daughter.
Yeah.
And so I hated that his team won last night, Georgia. I can't, you know what? But I did. Hey,
you're like every other SEC guy, you know, but more times than not, they hate Alabama.
Yeah,
hate on Alabama than Georgia. You know, I got a keyboard player from, he lives in Mount Juliet, as a matter of fact, and he's from Louisiana. LSU, I mean, just, and just can't stand Alabama.
Well, I don't like either one of them, but I did bet on Alabama, so I was a little upset that they lost last night.
Well, and when you got a little money on it,
Georgia's had it too good.
Then the spread's the only thing you're pulling for.
That's true. Yeah. And I thought they were going to cover 3 points. But Georgia won, the Braves won the World Series, and then the Bulldogs won the national championship.
Yeah.
Travis had it too good. He got engaged. Like, life's going too good for him.
Hey, just hopefully they'll finally quit crying about losing to Alabama and, you know, and all that
stuff. They'll find something else to cry
about. Oh, my gosh.
Were you at his place last night?
Yeah.
You guys stayed there?
Yeah.
And what was that like during the game? Was he pretty
intense? Yeah. Let me tell you something. People know when you grow up in Georgia, you are brought up specifically, mainly on Georgia football. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's the way he was. I mean, he just absolutely standing up, can't sit down. I mean, he's cussing the refs. I mean, he's cussing me
about the refs on Twitter last night. I'm not reffing the game.
I mean, he's like, you might as well just quit now. And just, if you're going to call it, like, you know, I mean, he was more entertaining than the game was at the time, actually. But, I got a lot of Georgia friends, a lot of talented people from Georgia here in Nashville and everything, obviously. So my son Walker and Travis, I mean, it's like when you come to Nashville, it's like Georgia's everywhere, you know.
Everywhere.
So they get to hear about Georgia all the time and the dogs and everything, you know. So
we need more Arkansas here. A little less Kentucky. One of my dearest friends is Matt Jones, who does Kentucky Sports Radio.
Yeah.
And he will not everything he writes is about Kentucky all the time. And I'm like, dude, stop it. He goes, well, that's my career. And I'm like, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Well, he does a great job at it. And he's, you know, he's got it going pretty good up there.
He does have it going pretty good.
I'll tell you now. And he knocks a far out of a golf ball, too. I mean, he's Kentucky.
You play golf with Matt?
I did. Yeah. We played in the first year they had. I'm a member of Champions Trace, which now holds that yearly golf PGA event, the Barbasol. And it's usually held during the Open Championship, but they moved it a week ahead this time. So it's actually going to whoever wins that gets to go to the Open. Mm. So it's become real important now. But first year they had it, me and him, Tubby Smith, a couple other guys were on the same team together, and we tied. We lost in a card playoff. Okay, we lost to a card playoff to the number one sponsor of.
Oh, classic.
Team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Classic sponsor.
So, no questioning about that at all, you know, no conspiracy theories there.
I'll keep mine then for you. You don't have to say it. I have mine for you.
You know, but.
I was talking to Luke Bryan, who's also a Georgia guy, and I was talking to him about the game, and he's like, I feel like I've been in a prize fight. He goes, it was so emotional. He says, physically, I'm tired. I feel like I've been boxing 12 rounds.
Well, I tell you what, you know, our coach, Coach Stoops, I mean, I play golf with him too, and he's a—
You know Coach Stoops?
Know him.
Wow.
I know him well. He's a great guy.
But you're glad he didn't leave, huh?
Oh, I'm tickled
to
death he didn't leave.
Yeah.
You know, but, I mean, he has been so good for Kentucky football because I'm a closet. I mean, everybody loves basketball up there, but I've always loved college football better than anything in the world. He has done a remarkable job, and but we've played some rounds together, and just an enjoyable guy. But he's fiery. I mean, he has turned Kentucky around into when they have close games where they usually lost.
Like how Mommy would play close, the way he wouldn't win.
Yeah, and that's been we call it the coach. It's a curse from when we had
Joker Phillips.
No. Back when in the 50s, we had Paul
Bear Bryant.
Bear Bryant.
Yeah.
And he went 11-0, even beat Oklahoma. They'd already named Oklahoma the championship, so it didn't matter. But we beat Oklahoma in the bowl game back then. And the rumor is the UK basketball won a national championship. They gave Rupp a brand new Cadillac, and they gave Paul, Coach Bryant, a little watch. And he said, "See y'all later, bye." And so we've been cursed ever since. Well, I think Mark, Coach Stoops, have finally lifted that curse. We beat Tennessee and Florida and all that. Yeah. It was over, you know. And
had
all
a good
that
year. And, yeah, won 10 games.
I mean, we love, you know, you know how it is. You love SEC, grow up SEC. You know, we love to see SEC teams do great. We think it's the best, you know, in the world. Arkansas is starting to show some signs of.
Hey, we won nine games.
You know, I mean, they gave, didn't they give Alabama a pretty good game?
Yeah, right to the very end.
I think they gave them the best game all year. So that was, you know, that's a good sign. I mean, now we're getting Texas and Oklahoma coming.
At some point.
At some point. You know, and so it's.
They're about to get a rude awakening. Texas and Oklahoma are. They're coming into a whole different
welcome to
league
big
of big
boy
boys.
World.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, for sure.
I mean, you know, the bottom line is, I mean, it's just. There's no doubt about it. If you look in the NFL, the amount of SEC players that's in the NFL, it's just, I mean, it's a very talented, what do you call it, conference. Yeah.
This has been Sports Talk with John Michael and Bobby.
Yeah.
Coming at you quarter past every hour.
Yeah, we'll get the weather next.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming by.
Oh, absolutely, man.
You
I always
know, just a big fan of yours.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you. I'm trying to keep the aging, you know, stay from catching up with me so fast. I'm losing ground a little bit, you know. I'm getting ready to turn 57.
I think we all are. I don't think you gain ground on that, though. I think that's something that you just lose ground and you accept it or you don't.
Yeah, I'm kind of having to accept that, I guess. But I'm enjoying life, you know. I mean, it's gone by fast. I can't, you know, it's hard to believe. Well, this year is my 30th year out on the road when I think Life's a Dance came out in September of 1992. It's hard to believe that that's been 30 years ago.
Wow.
I mean, it's just like, wow, okay. And then, of course, I've got two kids that are, one's getting married and the other one's, you know, down here writing songs and this and that and trying to make a living in the music business too. And, I mean, it's just like, it's just unbelievable how fast it goes by. So, you know, I enjoy get to be once in a while tell my story, and I appreciate you allowing me to come on and do that.
Oh, are you kidding? Big fan. Let's go over to Reed, who gets one awkward question at the end of every interview. Reed, our video guy, what is your one question?
All right, I came prepared this time.
Oh, yeah, no, I hate to hear that.
Prepared. All right, now just one question. Who are some of your musical, like, inspirations growing up?
Well, I mean, I grew up, my dad, obviously, I watched him on stage. He was a great entertainer, but listening to the radio all the time, it was no doubt George Strait. I loved George Strait when he came out. And I think it was 79. Alabama came out around 79 and 80. Lionel Richie, obviously. I wore his cassette tapes out. I mean, I said cassette tapes, that's correct. And of course, love Journey and love the Eagles, Bob Seger's. I mean, I grew up in an era, which I think, you know, from the 70s and 80s, that was just absolutely incredibly rich with just all this incredible music. And now I hear it a lot on commercials and stuff. You hear these 70s and 80s big hits from that day. They're using it to get people to buy the product. I'm like, you know, there's a reason behind it. That music was that good. It had me, too. I mean, I loved it. And I just feel like, you know, no doubt about it. I mean, it really helped me when I had to go in the studio for the first time to see if I even knew how to sing or cut a song. I never recorded anything in my life. And I'm up there singing Life's a Dance, and I hear myself back on these speakers, and I'm going, I look at producer, I'm going, is that any good? Do I sound like that?
Did you learn sheet music at all, or did you play by ear most of the time?
Just by ear. I mean, I wanted to be a piano player. I loved piano, and I went and got some lessons. But, you know, we moved around a lot. Moving a piano was not easy. So we had an old brown log stove, and it was heavy, and that was about to it took up the place for the piano to keep us. You know, Dad carried that thing around everywhere we went. You know, we lived in a double wide, and this 250-pound old coal burning stove we put in this double wide. I don't know how we didn't burn the place down. But anyway, those guys, I wore out their cassette tapes. I mean, just loved it. And I remember getting, you know, the greatest hits the Eagles came out with the first time and all that stuff. And when I'm in the car, my pickup truck today, if I listen to the radio, I listen to my old classic favorites. I just love it.
Bobby Bones. That's what you meant to say. No, said that wrong. You mispronounced my name. You said old classic favorites when you're supposed to say Bobby Bones Show. But okay, hey, whatever. You just didn't say an accent. It's probably the accent.
I get that a lot.
Hey, John Michael, thank you
appreciate
very much.
It, man. Yeah, thank you so much.
Just a real treat. And you guys can follow John Michael Montgomery on Instagram. I don't know how often you're actually posting stuff yourself, but I'm going to say it's you all the time.
Wife is, she's got my back on this, you know. So my brother's got my back. My wife's got my back. I got the.
You got two backs. That's not true. You should have a back and a front. You got two backs.
They're sore backs, too.
@ John Michael Montgomery. Yeah. Hey, great to see you.
Thank you.